We acknowledge the deep connection that Indigenous people all over the world have to the land where they live.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
Keep that tradition going.
The world from an Indigenous perspective. With Larissa Barrett.
And we stand together as one.
On ABC Local Radio.
This week, the Victorian government leads the country in tackling family violence.
In any one year, you can get up to 3,000 notifications. So if you think about a percentage of those, up to 90% are for family violence. It gives you a bit of an idea of how many families you're actually seeing. So it is a significant number, considering we're only a small percentage of the whole population in Victoria. But if you look at the overrepresentation in out-of-home care, we're 14% of children in the whole system.
And with Secrecy and Dispatch commemorating 200 years since the Appin massacre.
It's been incredibly draining, and it's been a most wonderful experience. And in a way, I've never had to work before. The actual topic and the theme demanded that we be as inclusive as possible with the local people, and that was a great experience. So a kind of methodology I've not had to use before, but it was a very enriching experience.
Hello and welcome to Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Those stories are coming up, but first, a look at the big stories that have made headlines over the past 7 days. And joining me for this week's panel discussion are the CEO of the National Centre of Indigenous Excellence, Kirsty Parker, founder of Indigenous X and social media expert, Luke Pearson, and the director of the South Australian Aboriginal Drug and Alcohol Council, Scott Wilson. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, let's start with the federal government's relations with peak Indigenous bodies. Kirsty, you're a former co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples. Malcolm Turnbull met with the new co-chairs just last weekend after months in the role as Prime Minister. What would you expect to come out of such a meeting, and how do you think this bodes for future engagement?
Well, I think it's a small step forward. During my term as co-chair, and as far as I'm aware for the previous co-chair's roles, there were no meetings with prime ministers, so there wasn't the sort of respectful relationship you would expect from the head of the national government and then the peak representative body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So of course it's a step forward, but meetings are only as good as their outcomes, and we've yet to see what the outcomes will be. I would imagine that Congress would have been messaging all around the relationship with our people, the important work that government really needs to do to make sure that it is fit for the purpose of dealing with our people and respecting our institutions. So, you know, it's a very preliminary kind of a step. I wouldn't want to say that I'm optimistic, but I would love to see a much stronger relationship forged. It has to be respectful on both sides, and I know that Congress as an organisation was very respectful of government. It needs to filter down, and there needs to be respect also for the makeup of Congress, because we often talk about Congress as an isolated body. In fact, you know, it has 180 organisations around the country, including virtually every national peak, has extraordinary reach into our communities and individual members as well, who bring extraordinary skills. And we know that one of the biggest problems with the way that governments engage with our people is that they may impose solutions from Canberra when there's very little experience of what is actually happening on the ground and appreciation for the diversity in our communities also. So a good first step, and we'll see how we go from here.
So you're just you're watching it at the moment. Scott, you've had a long history of engaging with governments at all levels with the sort of work you do. Are you optimistic under the current Turnbull government in the area you're working in?
Not really. I suppose, yeah, you're right. You know, I've been working at a peak body now since 1993. So we've been quite successful in maintaining, I suppose, that focus on drug and alcohol. But I'll just give you a quick example. In 2004, myself and a range of other Aboriginal people were put onto a government advisory committee called NIDAC, National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee. You know, I was deputy chair for that period of time from 2004 until Joe Hockey's MyUFO last year, where to save $190,000, they abolished NIDAC. And that was the only voice, really, in terms of drug and alcohol that we had. Because we, like I said, we're a subcommittee of the Australian National Council of Drugs, so we knew that the advice, and we were made up of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people from around the country, that could actually give direct to the Prime Minister and other ministers advice and things like that about drug and alcohol, which led to the rollout of Opal Fuel, for example, and a whole range of other things. Whereas now, it was quite interesting. I was rung up a couple of months ago by one of the government bods to sort of ask me whether, oh, Scott, you know, we're sort of setting up this thing. Can you tell us how we go about consulting with the Aboriginal folk? And I sort of said, oh, considering you had a whole committee structure with experts and, you know, that was around for 11 years, you just abolished it, you could have went to them. And unfortunately, what happens now is that I get, and I assume other members as well, get a lot of inquiries, requests from government and non-government organisations for, you know, advice and that, whereas prior to that, when you had NIDAC, it was a collective voice, whereas now it's probably just my voice or individual voices. And so I'm a bit sort of concerned that government has stopped listening. And I understand Kirsty's bringing up about Congress, but, you know, we're organisational members of Congress. Whether they are around in a year or two bodes not well, considering that the federal government has consistently said that they're not going to provide them with any more money. So unfortunately, we could see that sort of disappear. And then you've got to ask, in the health arena, besides NACHO, there is no other, or there, it's getting to the stage where there isn't any voice for Aboriginal folk at that level.
Yeah, I might just bring Luke in on that because, of course, Kirsty talks about this history of lack of engagement with Congress, which was actually a body that was established by the Indigenous community. And then now we hear Scott talking about the way in which places where there's expertise to tap into get abolished because of budget cuts. What are your thoughts, Luke, on how federal governments should be engaging with Indigenous people?
Yeah, well, much like both have said, but particularly, you know, with what Scott was saying, I think when the federal government brought in the Indigenous Advisory Council, which seemed good at the start when it first came, but straight off the back of it was the abolishing of a lot of other, you know, more sectional, more industry-specific advisory groups. And so I was having some involvement with some in education, but I know similar things happened in health, in education and across the board. And so that idea of, you know, we're cutting red tape and we're streamlining, you can't have one single group of, what is it, like a dozen or so people on the Indigenous advisory group advising across all of these issues as well as we could have had and did have with those peak bodies. So I think it's a worrying trend. But yeah, the sad truth when we did have a lot of those groups is quite often they'd leave the meetings with government very frustrated that all their work and all their reporting and all their consultation with communities would be heard by government but wouldn't be acted on. So I guess now they've just streamlined the process of how to ignore us. So
on another issue that seems to come up almost every week, because it is touted as top of the agenda, is constitutional reform or recognition. A new survey shows that the referendum push is marked by confusion and the target date of May 27 next year is unrealistic. This survey was done by National Congress and it shows strong support for a treaty as the first priority by most respondents. Kirsty, where do you stand on this issue?
I think my position hasn't changed one iota since I was in Congress and was speaking regularly on these issues, that this is a matter first and foremost for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to determine how we will take it forward. That's why I was so passionate about working with other Indigenous representatives, Paddy Dodson, for example, Noel Pearson, Megan Davis, but also many other people in our communities, to insist on an Indigenous-led and Indigenous-designed process as part of, I guess, the latest wave of consultations. I do feel that that's a process that could have been undertaken earlier and had to rally to get agreement on that. I'm very glad that we eventually did. But that's going to be the most important thing for me. I personally feel that the specific changes that are being sought to the Constitution are extremely important. Many of them are very difficult to argue against. You know, the prohibition on racial discrimination, for example, I can't imagine how that would be a bad thing. I feel that I have had seen, you know, or felt little trust in the behaviours of state and territory governments in particular in the way that they deal with our people. So I would be provided with a level of comfort, for example, around the Commonwealth retaining their decision-making power, I guess, but only so far as that they were not to racially discriminate against our people. But I also understand, and I believe that they can be parallel processes, and I've always insisted that why do we need to choose? This is the only way that we can advance our people. We have a right to avail ourselves of everything that is at our fingertips or perhaps beyond our fingertips. So I support constitutional change so long as it's meaningful. I don't want just some pretty words. I want it to make a difference to our people's lives. I want it to make a difference in the way that governments engage with us and require them or compel them to do that in a respectful, meaningful way. But I also, you know, am enamoured with the discussions that are had within our community around a treaty also. So, you know, how that's brought to bear is going to be a very big question. And, of course, there's a discussion in the community around which priority do we perhaps pursue both at the same time and perhaps try and bring them together. That will evolve over time, I imagine, but I'm completely comfortable with it being our community that leads these discussions.
And Scott, what about you? Have you been following these debates very much? Where do you sit in terms of constitutional recognition and treaty?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I agree with Kirsty that, you know, yes, you do need constitutional recognition, but at the end of the day, I still don't see why there is no treaty amongst Aboriginal people and, you know, mainstream Australia, considering that people have been calling for that for, you know, as long as I can recall. You know, Yothu Yindi's song went worldwide, you know, and I thought that, you know, the whole reconciliation process that I was heavily involved in at the start did sort of garner a lot of support nationally. But then all of a sudden, overnight, it's almost like all of that goodwill and motivation and mobilisation just sort of vanished. And then we have had a period of, you know, very negative sort of commenting and things happening in Australia. But I still actually think that for us to sort of go forward, there needs to be some sort of treaty document. But notwithstanding that, at the same time, and you know that could take a little bit longer. But the constitutional recognition should have happened when they wrote the Australia Act or enacted that in 1901. You know, and then that whole issue could have at least been included. We would have been part of the whole process. Whereas up until now, I still think a lot of Aboriginal people feel as if they're not even part of the process.
Luke, you keep your finger on the pulse a bit through Indigenous X. Before we get to your personal views about it, what's your sense of what the landscape is on this? Because we see polls that kind of give us different answers on how much support there is.
Yeah, massively differing results from various surveys that have popped up. But I think, you know, treaty, for one, I think it's, you know, certainly within my lifetime, the desire for it's always been there. I think that desire will always be there, and I think it will inevitably have to happen. It's just a matter of when, and then that will be the conversation of the fine print of what's in that treaty document. Whereas, you know, constitutional recognition, I think, really has a very limited time frame, and I don't think has ever really enjoyed the same level of, you know, popular support that we've had for a treaty. And, you know, like we're talking about not being interested in a symbolic form of recognition, I think the community consultations, you know, I've said before, I think they really should have happened much earlier in the process. And I think not having them earlier has just furthered that cynicism towards it. And I think we're really starting to see that in the media as well now. I think there's probably media have been covering the story a few years, are a bit more interested in other perspectives of it, and certainly, you know, happy to play to that controversy around one or the other and the yes or no in a way that they, you know, certainly weren't at the start of the campaign. So I think it's really, its last shot is these community consultations and getting popular support within that process, and whether that's possible at this stage.
And for those who haven't read your commentary, where do you come down on the debate?
Well, for me, like I said, it's hard to say yes or no to, you know, recognition or treaty until there's actually fine print. I mean, both of those are the headings of separate documents, and I believe it is possible to have constitutional change that would be meaningful. I think the government would probably prefer to have symbolic only, and so that's where it comes down to these community consultations and then the process after that to push for something meaningful, or it'll just fade away. So I guess I would say I'm cynical, but if if that fine print that finally comes out is significant and meaningful with what we've seen in constitutional recognition in other countries, then we're going to look at that. But, yeah, I'm not really holding my breath for that to happen.
Oh, Larissa, I just wanted to pick up on the point that Luke made. It's important, I think, that people understand that the insistence of our people that any change to the Constitution be meaningful is not a new thing. No. This has been around for years, and particularly in the last, you know, rush of consultations through the expert panel that reported 5 or 6 years ago now, they gave us a mud map. There were very specific recommendations around the types of changes, and, you know, a preambular change is just one of those things. We also, I think, need to recognise that within our community we have quite a bit of work to do and heavy lifting to do around treaties, the nature of it, who would it be, what would, you know, what would be encompassed in these documents. So that's it's essential that we don't just stop at the headlines, that we really need to delve down and do a lot of work ourselves so that we can guide this process.
Lots of questions. You're listening to Speaking Out on ABC Local Radio. I'm Larissa Berendt, and my guests this evening are Kirsty Parker, Scott Wilson and Luke Pearson.
And the church needs to understand too that every church in this country is built on stolen land. And the Bible clearly says, thou shalt not steal. And the Bible also clearly says, thou shalt not kill. So the repentance for this particular country needs to come back to that. Get rid of this doctrine of terra nullius. Even though the Mabo case might have pointed us in that direction, it's still alive today. Terra nullius. We do not exist. So put us in jail.
On the ABC's Q&A program this week, Pastor Ray Minikin appeared on a panel to discuss the role of the church and what it should be doing in working towards reconciliation and justice. Luke, in your opinion, does the church still need to be held accountable for what it's done in the past?
Yeah, unquestionably. For me, it's, you know, when we're talking about reconciliation, when we're talking about, you know, government accountability in terms of past actions, the church has played a very heavy role in a lot of that history, and a lot of it is not that far back in our history. You know, in the Bring Them Home report, there was a whole raft of recommendations specifically for the churches, and not all of those have been picked up. I don't even think that many have been. So, yeah, most definitely, and particularly for a group, as was just said in the clip, that holds itself to very high standards, I don't think they've done that in practice. So I think, yeah, there's a lot they still have to answer for.
Kirsty, in relation to the role that the church can play in reconciliation, what do you think it needs to be doing to engage with Indigenous communities, given its history that we've been speaking about?
Well, I think the churches can do tremendous good in this area. Probably ironic that I use that term, given the alternative term of do-gooder. Many of the churches are starting to recalibrate their relationship with our communities, and we have to bear in mind that many of our mob follow particular faiths. They are deeply immersed and embedded in their own Aboriginal identity and culture and spirituality, but also may observe a Christian faith, for example. And I think that Pastor Ray Minikin did a remarkable job on Q&A. He was amazing, staunch, dignified and so on, but very, very strong. And the churches, I think, need to do what we would expect of anyone to make them fit for a relationship with us in a way that they haven't previously been, and that is to allow us to speak about the past, to be very honest and open about it, for there to be an understanding around the extreme level of trauma and grief that's been perpetrated against our people, in some cases in the name of church and so on, and allow us to lead. And, you know, we're very well placed because we do have, as I say, some of our people in very high and influential positions in the church. You know, one of the things about, I guess, that's common to most faiths, most religions is, you know, do no wrong unto your fellow man or woman, and where you can make amends. It's not a quick fix. You know, the extent of the trauma was so great that we've scarcely begun to recover from it. We know the role of the churches, for example, in the removal of children and so on. Every single Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person I know today is still deeply impacted by those removal policies. So have a conversation with us, ask us what it is that we need, and then work with us to do it.
Well, finally tonight, we always ask a lighter question. And this week in the news, we couldn't help but notice a Gold Coast woman who has had her pet ducks attack her every time she goes into the yard. It only started after she fell pregnant, but it made us want to ask our panel the question, what is the angriest animal you've ever come up against, Luke?
Yeah, ducks are pretty phenomenal, actually. I'll back that up. I can remember once back when I was doing uni at Newcastle and doing a quick dash across a six-lane highway, which I don't recommend kids. I was running late to class and did the dash, didn't see a group of ducks that were there, sidestepped them at the last minute, and they bashed me for the next couple of hundred metres. It was absolutely horrific with six lanes of traffic all slowing down to watch me. So, watch out for the ducks.
What about you, Scott? Angriest animal you've ever come up against?
Was a little pug dog, you know, those little, like I was door knocking and I could hear these dogs and I knew they were coming, and so I thought I'd take off, and as I leapt over the fence and landed on the ground and broke my leg, turned around because I didn't realise how big the dog was, right? And then when I turned around, I realised it was just one of those little pug dogs, but he was pretty savage and... Yeah, so that would have been the angriest one I've ever confronted.
Yeah, broke your leg. And what about you, Kirsty? Angriest animal you've ever come up against?
Well, I don't need to talk in past term because I'm living with it every day, and that's my cat. Ah. My cat, Jenny, who is, you know, she's going to have her own social media profile out of this conversation, I'm sure, who is extremely resentful if you move her from her prime position on the bed. I can show you scars. Right now on my wrist, on my ankle, she will bite my leg like a dog if she's, dislodged from prime position. So sadly, I'm still living with it.
Yeah, I know all about cats that think they own the house. I sympathise with all of you. And our guest this evening, Kirsty Parker, CEO of the National Centre of Indigenous Excellence, Director of the South Australian Drug and Alcohol Council, Scott Wilson, and Luke Pearson, founder of Indigenous X and social media expert. Thank you all so much for coming on the show and sharing your views with us tonight.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Local Radio.
Shortly, you'll hear from Muriel Bamblett. She's worked in the child and family services sector since the early 1990s, and this week the Victorian government may have made her job just that little bit easier, announcing targeted funding for early intervention and prevention programs. You're listening to Speaking Out on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia on podcast and via the ABC Radio app. I'm Larissa Berendt.
Check out the Speaking Out highlights, soundcloud.com/ABC Speaking Out.
Last week, the Victorian government announced a commitment of more than $570 million to address family violence in the state budget. Of that, more than $25 million has been earmarked for Aboriginal communities, targeting early intervention and prevention programs. The move has been welcomed by the Victorian Aboriginal Child Care Agency. And to discuss the significance of the funding, I'm joined on the program this evening by the service's CEO, Muriel Bamblett. Muriel, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Larissa.
So to begin with, you've been involved with this sector for more than 25 years. Over that time, what impacts have you seen family violence have on our communities?
Well, I think that every day the numbers of particularly notifications for Aboriginal children to child protection, you know, you see firsthand the impact on children. So, you know, almost 90% of Aboriginal children that come into care in Victoria come into care because of family violence. And so with the Royal Commission in Victoria, we've seen a massive spike in the number of Aboriginal families that have been notified. So again, this is something that's causing real concern because we have now a system where the police respond much more vigorously to family violence, given it, you know, the number of deaths in Victoria.
As an organisation that's dedicated to addressing these issues, how many cases would you see?
Well, we receive, obviously, every notification for an Aboriginal child except in the Mildura area. And so in any one year, you can get up to 3,000 notifications. So if you think about, you know, a percentage of those, if, you know, up to 90% are for family violence, it gives you a bit of an idea of how many families you're actually seeing. So It is a significant number considering we're only a small percentage of the population, whole population in Victoria. But if you look at the overrepresentation in out-of-home care, we're 14% of children in the whole system. So, and less than, you know, sort of 5% of the, 0.5% of the total population. So it says that family violence has a significant impact on our community.
Now, given that, can you just explain to us what the significance of this week's announcement is?
Well, I think they did now announce that there was $25 million. It's not all going to the area of family violence, but the Premier has really signalled that the, you know, $570 million is a start. It's just the start of the process. And so at the moment, it's really important that the Aboriginal community, that we start to do the work about what does the whole system look like, what does the policy, the practice, what are the programs, what services. And so there are, you know, planned numerous meetings to get Aboriginal communities together to start to work out a plan, because the Premier wants a response to the current recommendations. Clearly there are 227, there are 9 specific to Aboriginal, but we really want to look at how do we inform all of the recommendations. The Premier wants to know what is the plan for Aboriginal people, what are the priorities, and so we're working very hard to put together what our response is to the recommendations, to the Royal Commission findings, and to start to look at what a new system will look like.
You've just talked about the role you'll be playing in planning and prioritising, but can you just explain to us the importance of having the funding channelled into community-controlled organisations and programs?
Look, we know, and Aboriginal communities know, that Aboriginal people self-determining and being able to control and run and do programs, we get better results, we get better engagement, Aboriginal communities involved, engage in the process. And I think it's really important that we also are signaling to our own community and to our own people that we're not going to stand up, we're going to stand against violence, that we don't condone violence in our communities. But we also want to come up with solutions. We also want to be about challenging the myths about violence in our communities. But we also recognise the importance of healing and healing transgenerational trauma and dealing with the institutional impact of the past on our families. And so if we don't come up with approaches that specifically address the issues for our families and our communities, if we don't empower young women to be able to understand the importance of getting into, you know, healthy relationships and understanding their important, the rights that they have as young women growing up in our communities.
And so it really is about intervention and prevention, isn't it? It's not about coming in the crisis.
Well, I think it's a part about all of the system. I think, you know, we want to be able to immediately respond to the violence, so because it is the cycle of violence very much is about the episode of violence and then entering into the different stages. And we want to be able to understand why, what are the tipping points, what are the issues that contribute to the violence in the first place. So you need to be able to respond to that. You need to be able to have perpetrator-victim programs. You need to be able to have programs, you know, across the whole system. The danger is if you only give us the tertiary end, then we don't get to understand what are the things that contribute to family violence as well. And how do we educate and raise awareness in the community? So whilst early intervention and prevention are critical, it's really important too that we have Aboriginal people advising government at the highest level about what the system needs to do to change. How do the police respond to Aboriginal people? How do the courts respond? How do all of the hospitals and all of those systems actually respond to Aboriginal people at the centre of family violence?
Recently, we've seen a federal advertising campaign targeting the influences of family violence. Do you see those sort of advertising campaigns as effective?
Look, I think it's important that they have a very much a cultural context. And I think that, you know, and they put into context the issue of family violence. Often it's portrayed as one-on-one violence, and it doesn't give a historical background to family violence and how that contributes to family violence in the home. And so I think imaging and portraying family violence, and we've done a lot of work here in Victoria. We've produced and worked with people that have been involved in family violence and got them to tell their story. And their story is very much about the impact of poverty on them and the impact of neglect and being in a cycle of poverty and being able to break out of that and understanding how poverty impacts on family violence, on the fact that, you know, it's very difficult when you can't get a house and you can't get a home and you can't get a job. All those things contribute to the cycle of violence, and so understanding those contributors as well is really important in understanding the message of family violence.
Muriel, are Aboriginal men stepping up in terms of their response to this issue?
Clearly the data says no. I mean, and clearly we need to do a lot more around having men understand how their behaviour and that violence is not on. I think that if we don't have treatment programs, if we don't have men's behaviour change, if we don't have Aboriginal men engaging, far too many of our Aboriginal men don't participate. But Larissa, I'd be remiss if I don't say that, you know, whilst it's purported that and reported constantly about Aboriginal family violence, quite often we have Aboriginal women that are victims of family violence and their partners are not Aboriginal. And so understanding the data, and so I believe that, you know, it's an overrepresentation of portraying Aboriginal men as the sole perpetrators of violence against Aboriginal women quite often is misleading. And so we do know that a lot of Aboriginal men, 80% of our people, are doing really well, and we've seen numerous programs in Victoria. We have the Aboriginal Fitzroy Stars, they're an Aboriginal team, and we've got Rumbalara, they've signed up to White Ribbon. And what we've been really proud of is, you know, there's 40, 50 players in that club, and not one of them have been, you know, the source of a report to the police for family violence. So there are people that are making stands, but I think far more needs to be done to engage Aboriginal men in change.
Well, you mentioned that the $25 million announcement, the earmarking in this budget round, was a first step. What are the next steps?
I think that whilst they did announce $25 million, 16 of that is for the roadmap to reform, and so it's an investment in Aboriginal child and family welfare. It's around Aboriginal guardianship. It's around transferring Aboriginal children to Aboriginal communities. So a lot of that funding, whilst it's targeted and being put as $25 million to Aboriginal family violence, the real figure is approximately $9 million. So certainly we're still very disappointed in the fact that only $9 million, but the Premier has said this is the beginning, it's not the end. And so there's one of the recommendations is to implement the 10-year plan for family violence, and so it's really now important. So in the next few weeks we'll be looking at the 9 recommendations and putting forward much more concrete actions as to what this government needs to do and what they need to fund. So there's quite a lot of work that the Aboriginal community needs to do. It's important that we have Aboriginal people on that victim support group, victim advisory group, with Rosie Batty heading up, because we need to hear the voice of victims. And so it's really important that we have an Aboriginal person on that that talks about Aboriginal women. I think that if we don't come out of this with some really concrete resources for Aboriginal women, if we don't have supports, if we don't have the system to better support victims of family violence, then we would have failed.
And finally, Muriel, I have to ask, 25 years working at the coalface on these issues, how do you stay strong? You see a lot of things around you that are difficult. It's been a long struggle to get to where you are now. There's still a long way to go. How do you personally keep strong to keep going?
I think I take pride in the fact that not only am I working in child welfare, but I see a lot of really strong cultural work, and we've added culture to it. And so when you see a system that's moving from being just a mainstream system, but a system for Aboriginal people, you really feel proud of that. And that's what drives you. And I think you always focus on what the end product is and what do you want to achieve. And when you really are passionate about community, and when you really love your community, and, you know, you bleed for your community, you live for your community, And it's the very essence of who you are, being Aboriginal. And I'm just so very proud of it. And I'm, you know, very proud at the moment to be a Victorian, because I think that we are a very strong Aboriginal people. And I think that, you know, we work hard together to bring about results. But it is about, I think, the thing that drives me is just, I'm just such a very proud Aboriginal person. I'm so strong in my who I am, and that's been the most important thing to me throughout my life.
Muriel Bamblett, thank you so much for being with us on Speaking Out this evening.
Thank you, Larissa.
That was Muriel Bamblett, who is the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Child Care Agency.
Join the conversation online, facebook.com/ABC Speaking Out.
Look, listen, and learn knowledge.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Larissa Berendt. Coming up, you'll hear from Tess Ellis. Tess is a well-established curator in the Indigenous arts sector. Her latest project has been curating a compelling exhibition at the Campbelltown Arts Centre in Sydney's West. It was launched recently to commemorate 200 years since the Appin Massacre just outside of Sydney.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Local Radio.
Tess Ellis has worked in the field of Aboriginal art and cultural practice since the early 1990s. She's curated a number of exhibitions in Sydney venues, including the Sydney Opera House and Carriage Works. She's also curated a number of international print exhibitions in Canada for the Montreal First Nations Festival and the Kluge Roo Aboriginal Art Collection in the United States. Her latest work has been curating the exhibition From Secrecy and Dispatch, which is currently on display at the Campbelltown Arts Centre in Sydney's West. Tess, hello, and thank you for joining us on Speaking Out this evening.
It's a pleasure.
Now, first up, the exhibition opened to mark the 200th anniversary of the Appin Massacre. Can you just tell us a little bit about that massacre and why it's so important?
That massacre is very important. It happened 200 years ago on the 17th of April, and it was the first massacre that we know, documented massacre, that we're aware of in our country. And it was ordered, as if you like, by the then governor of the time, Lachlan Macquarie.
And how many artists are there in the exhibition, and who have you got there? Because it's an amazing calibre of people you've brought together.
We've brought 10 commissioned artists from across our country and Canada, 6 from Australia and 4 from Canada, as well as works that were pre-existing that we were able to source from private collections and institutional collections.
So just tell us how some of the works of art that you've picked or commissioned help explain or tell the story or have a response to the massacre.
Well, the commissioned artists we brought together and took them with a local elder, Glenda Chalker. We took them to the site, or when I say we, I say Campbelltown Arts Centre, brought them out or down or up from their various
the
communities, yes, and took them to the Appin Massacre site as best we could get access to, and had meetings with the curatorium, of which Glenda was part of. And from there, they went back home to their home communities and pondered for a while and worked out what it was they were going to do and how they were going to respond. Some responded directly to what happened at Appin, and others responded with instances of their brutalities from their own communities that were in, like, the genre, I suppose, of brutalities.
Mm. So can you give us some examples of some of these really emotional responses that the artists had?
Yeah, I'm going to cry, I think. Frances Bell Parker knew almost immediately what she was going to do, and she decided to make 20 panels, canvas panels, and 24 that denotes to, each one denotes 10 years. So there was 200 years, 20 panels. And she painted and painted and painted and overlaid each panel 9 times with the work, a landscape, if you will, of the cliffs that most of the women and children in the massacre fell from. And in that, she had negative spaces within her overlaying of paint, which were then filled with the tears, which she believes would have been shed from the survivors and relatives of those people who were murdered.
That's very powerful. I mean, mm. some ways we can look at a historical event like this and get historians to give us a record. We can look at what the archive might say. What do we get as an audience when we go in to an exhibition like the one you've curated and see these kind of responses to it?
You get a more, it's like a stab in your heart, and it's very emotional. It's work that a lot of people can relate to, and it's also work that people would not expect in response to the massacre story. So at one point you think it's everything you expect, and the other at another point you're very challenged, as with the work of Adrian Stimson, one of the Canadian artists, who droned the massacre site in Appin, and also droned this a massacre site in his Blackfoot country in Canada. And we've put those two films together. We're just flying over quietly, flying over these sites. And that's quite amazing to see the massacre site on beautiful, beautiful Dharawal country and the massacre site in Canada under snow. So they were both filmed earlier this year. And so putting the two together and juxtaposing these sites is quite an emotional experience.
And I guess what you've been able to explore is the similar history of colonisation in both countries. How was it to have the Canadians and the Australian Indigenous people working together? And they'd come together for the workshops and things.
They came, some of them came together. The Canadians all came out at one point together en masse. So we had no Australian artists with them at that point, but everyone was given histories of everybody else's work. People understood where each other was coming from and understood each other's practice. And the caliber of artists we have was really, really high. So there was a lot of internationally recognised artists, such as Vernon Arkey and Julie Goff. So they didn't really work together. They worked in isolation, but were constantly informed of each other's comings and goings and thoughts.
And sounds like the Canadians had a very quick response, that it resonated as much for them, even though they came from a completely different country.
Yeah, well, the shared brutalities of colonisation, it's like a blueprint across the world, isn't it, and how to colonise a country. And it's similar, very similar stories across the world. For instance, Marianne Nicholson's work from Vancouver Island talks of the giving out of smallpox blankets and allowing smallpox to then march across her home communities and across the province of British Columbia is a very familiar story that we have here.
And as you mentioned earlier, some of the artists involved in the exhibition could take what happened at Appin and then translate that into what happened in their own country here in Australia. So you were able to have a look at those kind of synergies.
That's right, and they did so with the blessing of the curatorium that we put together, which was fantastic and a real relief for them.
Now tell me about the reaction of the Dharawal people, who were the traditional owners, whose ancestors were the victims of this massacre. How did they feel about the show, and what was their involvement?
Their involvement was right from the beginning. I asked for a curatorium to be formed, and we had a local leaders and elders from the community down there around Campbelltown and Appin to participate, and every few months we had a meeting and we let them know who the artists were, we spoke with them about their prior practice, we informed them of their ideas for the exhibition. Not one was had any hesitation about anything we presented them. And they also gave us ideas on where to find works and other information about the massacre itself or about other things that were going on they brought into the conversation. So one of the curatorium members thought that there might be some interesting information in the National War Memorial. So we drove down there and had a meeting down there. Unfortunately, we didn't find anything. But, you know, on his advice, we acted.
And just for you personally, what's the process been like for you?
It's been incredibly draining, and it's been a most wonderful experience. And in a way, I've never had to work before. The actual topic and the theme demanded that we be as inclusive as possible with the local people, and that was a great experience. So a kind of methodology I've not had to use before, but it was a very enriching experience, and being blessed, basically feeling blessed by working with the local people from the Lands Council, the council, Campbelltown Council, and local elders and other community leaders has been a very enriching experience. The work as it comes in has been incredibly emotional, like listening to artists, reading their artist statements has been incredibly trying and difficult, but it's been something I'll never forget, that, let's put it that way, but it's been a great experience overall.
But it's wonderful because it means that you've sort of also helped put the Appin Massacre back into consciousness as well.
Well, that's true, and out of that we have, because of the massacre exhibition and it being on the TV, a woman from Coffs Harbour who's a descendant from the other side, from someone in the 46th Regiment at the time, has made contact and drove down the other Sunday morning from Coffs Harbour to attend the memorial at the Appin Memorial at Cataract Dam, and to meet with, in particular, Glenda Chalker. And that has happened, and who knows what will come of that from there. So it's been an interesting, interesting outcome.
Tess Ellis, thank you so much for joining us on Speaking Out this evening.
It's a pleasure.
You can see With Secrecy and Dispatch at Campbelltown Arts Centre in Sydney's West. It's on until 12th of June. It's open every day from 10 o'clock. Well, that's the program for this week. Join us next week for more news, views and interviews from across Indigenous Australia. You can find us on Facebook and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Larissa Berendt. Thank you for joining us on Speaking Out.